This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
Welcome to the Context Podcast. My name is Lauren Dudzak, and today we are speaking with Dr. Dana Britton, author of the piece Keeping Rank, which has been featured in the fall 2012 issue of Contexts. Dr. Britton is currently the director of the Center for Women and Work and professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University. She is also a co-principal investigator on a National Science Foundation Advanced Paid Grant to study the transition between associate and full professor for faculty, mainly in the STEM fields. Her research shows that despite women's increasing numbers in the academy, they are still largely underrepresented at the highest faculty position, the rank of full professor. She's here with us now to talk about this glass ceiling and the barriers women face. Dana, thank you for sitting in on this podcast with us.
Sure.
So, as a woman currently employed at a research university, I was immediately struck after reading your article about the underrepresentation of women in the highest ranks of faculty positions, which is full professor.
Right.
I was hoping that we could begin just by having you explain a little bit to us about the ranking system with faculty members and maybe the glass ceiling that women tend to hit on their way to that top position.
Sure. I mean, generally in the tenure stream, we're talking about three ranks. So we're talking about assistant professor, which is the, you know, if you're lucky, the first job you get out of graduate school. And so you come on as an assistant professor on the tenure track. You have 6 years to produce and be judged worthy of tenure. If you are not, then you get a one-year contract and you find another job. If you are, then ultimately, usually, you're promoted to associate professor and tenured at the same time. At some universities, those are separate, but in most places, they happen at the same time. Once you become an associate professor, there is no time limit. There's no, you could, as one of the people I interviewed put it, you could die as associate professor and you know, it's fine. No one, you know, they don't put that on your tombstone. So you could be an associate forever, but ultimately either someone can put you up, they could nominate you for promotion to full, you could nominate yourself, you could, there are a variety of mechanisms. Some places have a formal review process to nominate people for full. But then you are nominated for promotion to full professor. And then the way that promotion and tenure in the academy works are that people at the next rank vote for you. So if you're going up for associate, then the associates and fulls vote for you. If you're going up for full, then the fulls are the committee who ultimately decide whether you're promoted to full. And then you're promoted to full professor, and that's happy. If you're not promoted to full professor, you don't lose your job. You just stay an associate professor, and you could, you know, go up again. If you look at the data nationally, what you see is that women are, if you look at the total percentage of women on faculty in degree-granting institutions, that number is around 37% or so. Women are overrepresented at the assistant level, so they're more than 30% of assistant. They're about equally represented at associate, so that suggests they're getting tenure in about the proportion that they exist in the population. They're underrepresented at about 19% of all full professors are women. And if you look, using the data the way that I like to work with them, if you look at the proportion of all faculty on a campus who are full professors, nationally speak, well, I mean, on this particular campus, those numbers are 22% of all women faculty are full professors, 47% of all men faculty are full professors. So men are, and even nationally, that's true, men are about twice as likely as women to be full professors. So that's the story.
So what are some of the barriers that women are facing then?
Yeah, that's a fine question, and that's partly what I've been trying to figure out. I'm in the process of analyzing those data. I think there are a variety of levels at which we can see problems. So you can see problems procedurally in terms of universities are notoriously reticent to say what it takes to be tenured or promoted. I did an analysis of tenure and promotion policies, and my favorite one of those policies says you're qualified to be promoted to full professor if you're qualified to be appointed at the rank of full professor.
But that sounds like a whole lot of
it's a tautology, right? It's completely circular. So, and as you face that policy, you don't have a lot of guidance.
Right.
So how would you know? So it comes down to either you have to know you're promotable to full or somebody else has to recognize you as promotable to full. And my sense is that facing those uncertain policies is not a gender neutral thing. So for men, they're much more likely, and I've interviewed a lot of faculty in science disciplines, so that's, I mean, not my entire sample is not science folk, but it is a lot. But men are more likely to have networks and people to tell them what the rules are. If they fail, it's not so dramatic because there are a bunch of men, and so it's not about that failure man. Nobody ever notices that. I think men face those uncertain standards with at least a network and a cushion. If you're the only woman in, say, you know, your mechanical engineering department or your electrical engineering department and you fail, you know, it's a bigger splash. And those women are also less likely to be connected to the networks of people who can tell them what the rules really are. So I think policies and procedures matter. I think there are duties, there are practices that matter, like the assignment of service. So women tend to do more service than men. The service that they tend to do is lower status service, so it's student service. And though I think, you know, the women I interview really care about doing that kind of student service, particularly often in the sciences, because they want to, you know, they often work with women students, that doesn't count. And so, you know, they're doing a whole lot of work, but not ultimately getting much credit for it. Service matters. Focus of research matters. Many of the women I've interviewed have been doing interdisciplinary work, and departments often don't know how to count interdisciplinary work because it's not, you know, it falls between the cracks of two disciplines, even though that's where funding structures are shifting more and more. Work-family matters. And I hesitate to emphasize work-family because my concern is that once you start talking about it, it becomes the only problem for women. And I don't think it is, right? But it certainly does matter. I mean, I spent a lot of time talking with women about how they timed their children, how they juggled childcare obligations, one of the things that I saw is that, you know, academic women are great maximizers of little tiny spaces of time. So they would say, you know, I timed my child so it would come over summer break, or I timed my child, you know, so it would arrive over sabbatical. Children don't always cooperate with that, as you might imagine. But suffice to say, I think those women are juggling in a way that men aren't. It's not to say that men don't do childcare, but it certainly is the case in my interviews that the topic of work-family was far more salient for the women I interviewed than it was for the men. So those things matter. I think department cultures matter. The long-term associates I interviewed were more likely than the men. Women were more likely than men to say they were working in departments that were difficult or toxic, that felt like difficult environments for them. So I think there are a range of things that matter. There's no single answer to why women are more likely to hit this ceiling than men.
The majority of your research focuses on the math and sciences, as you've stated.
Of my total sample, probably 80% are in the STEM disciplines, partly because of the way the research was funded.
Do you think that these types of trends, that these barriers will cut across disciplines then to include the social sciences and the humanities?
Yeah, no, there's good data on that. I mean, women are underrepresented across disciplines at the rank of full professor. And in some ways, given the higher percentage of women faculty in sociology and psychology, for example, the underrepresentation is pretty stark. You know, women, but that's because there are so many women in those fields to start with. But in the humanities, for example, in English, there is a long-standing pattern of women as long-term associates. They tend not to be. So I don't think this is a problem that exists only in the STEM disciplines. It exists in disciplines in which there are many more women.
Now, you explained in the article that women have increasingly moved into academic positions over the last few decades. Now, some would say, well, we just need more women to enter the field. We just need more women in that pipeline.
Right.
More women in the fields mean more women will eventually reach that position of full professor.
Yep.
But based on your research, how is that approach to women's participation problematic?
Yeah, that's the pipeline argument, right? And I do think, there's no denying that men have been at this longer, right? And so, you know, we would expect that there would be more men at the full professor ranks. But if you look at the data from 1999 to 2009, which is what I do in the article, what you see is that the proportion of men as full professors has declined somewhat over that period, and it's partly because they're aging out, they're retiring. they're dying off, they're whatever. But the proportion of women at full has not really increased over that period. So, I mean, I think what we know is that women are more likely to leak out of that pipeline than men are. So, you know, in the sciences, they might be more likely to leave the academy entirely and go, you know, get a job working in industry or because the academy is, you know, really lagged behind the business, sort of private business in terms of things like, you know, work-family accommodation. And, you know, in terms of dealing with some of the climate issues that we deal with in the academy that often are not proactively handled. And so I think over time, it's likely to suspect that the mix will change somewhat. Mm-hmm. But I don't think time is going to solve the problem.
One of my favorite parts in your article was your emphasis on this institutional reproduction. So the services at universities that not only need to perform to aid in student development, mm-hmm. but also that are necessary in order for the university, for the school to function.
Yep.
So things like mentoring, advising, teaching, those service things that you mentioned in the very beginning.
Yep.
So what role do women play in institutional reproduction?
Yeah, well, they're much more likely to be doing it. I mean, they're much more likely to be doing all of those things. You know, I mean, the paradox I describe in the piece is, you know, universities want to describe themselves as student-centered. You know, I mean, go look at the webpage. My guess, and I have not done a systematic survey of this, but my guess is that about, I don't know, 60-70% of anything you find on a university's webpage is stuff nobody's getting credit for. And so, you know, I mean, this is students have to be taught. Students have to be mentored. Students, you know, advising has to be done. The, you know, all kinds of service. Universities proliferate service tasks. So there's an interesting article recently by Karen Pike in which she calculated that in her department of 20 faculty, there were, I can't remember how many committees, but there were 55 seats to be filled on all of the committees in the department for 20 faculty, right? Which tells you something about the sort of the work of institutional reproduction. The academy just sort of multiplies these positions, but ultimately the people who do the work don't get any of the credit, right? And the paradox is that the academy wouldn't survive without it. I mean, the thing that the academy rewards is the kind of thing that makes people marketable, right? So go out and get more money, bring us, you know, even more money. But the problem is that if you're a big moneymaker, then somebody's going to swoop in and grab you. And then ultimately, you know, you take your capital elsewhere. But the stuff, that's when you think about that stuff, it's like legal tender in your wallet, transferable anywhere. The work you do teaching, mentoring, and service, it's use value. It's not consumption value. And women are disproportionately likely to be doing that work.
So you talked about this a little bit, but I wanted you to elaborate on what you would describe as that cookie cutter or ideal type of faculty mm-hmm. member and how that really contradicts with the reality of somebody's workload.
Well, the work that needs to be done. I think that term cookie cutter faculty member was a term I heard a lot, but I heard it especially from a group of men, which I was surprised about. I interviewed a number of older men in engineering. And one of the things I did not know when I started out was that at most places around the country, and certainly at the land grants where I did a lot of my interviews, engineering was essentially a teaching school. So the idea was that, you know, the engineering college served the community, and students would come, they'd become engineers, and they'd go out to work at this or that, you know, manufacturing plant, or, you know, work for the military base, or, you know, whatever in that community. And these guys, you know, who had been hired 20, 30 years ago, came to their jobs because that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to work with those undergraduate students. They wanted to train master's level engineers. They wanted to solve problems in their communities. And they felt at the time they were hired that that was really valuable, that was part of their mission, and they felt really strongly identified with it. What's happened over the years, and it's happened across disciplines, is that we now put a priority on one kind of faculty member. We put a priority on the faculty member who can do research, who can publish, and who can get money. And the thing about these guys that was interesting is they often had money because, you know, companies are willing to pay to get their problems solved. But the knowledge they produced was problem-based knowledge. So it was, you know, here's how to fix a widget in this factory, or here's how to improve this production process. It wasn't the kind of thing you would publish in an academic journal. It wasn't the, and they felt really strongly that, there was a time in which there was a place for various roles. People in departments who might be teachers, people in departments who might, you know, specialize in this kind of problem solving, people who might be the researchers. And they really felt like the model has completely shifted in terms of what they call the cookie cutter, right? Which is to say one kind of faculty member who does one thing and who does not have the same mission or connection to the community that they felt.
So then how would we reform the reward system?
Yeah.
In order to accommodate this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think when I started this work, I think my thought was, you know, I don't know if the people who funded it thought the same, but, you know, what's wrong with these women and why can't we fix them? And, you know, let's make them better so that they can be promoted to full. And I think, you know, ultimately the place I am now is much more a critique of what the institution rewards and what it doesn't reward, right? There have been some arguments about how to change this to create, you know, faculty positions that are divided differently so that people can concentrate on the thing they want to do. I worry about that because I think ultimately there is a status and reward system in the university, and my worry is, you know, let's say we create a teaching track, then my worry is that only women will wind up in the teaching track in the lowest status positions and be paid the least. And but it seems to me there at some level needs to be a revaluing of the work that really needs to be done in terms of, you know, teaching and advising. The challenge in universities right now is that the proportion of state support for universities has been declining significantly over time. Federal money at this university comes with 54% overhead. So, you know, if I write a $1 million grant, then I get $540,000 on top of that goes to the university. And that fills a lot of gaps, right? That can do a lot of maintenance. It can pay a lot of salaries. It can, and so that's where the priority has been. But ultimately, that has, I think even more so, that has led to the undervaluing of this work of, you know, teaching and advising and service. I, like most sociologists, I don't have an answer, I suspect. But I do think it's worth a broader conversation about what we value and who benefits from the fact that we value it.
Well, one thing that I think that your article does a great job of is showing how complex this entire situation is. Policies are fantastic, but they're really only as good as a culture that would support those policies.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
In what ways have you found, based on your research, culture either helping or hindering women?
Mm. Well, I mean, that argument in some interviews, because I kept trying to test this out, because my argument as a sociologist, I love social structures, I love policies, I love, you know, I'm ultimately not all that, you know, not a great believer that I'm going to change people's hearts, but if I can change the rules, then maybe the hearts will follow, right? And, you know, a psychiatrist might think in the other direction. But suffice to say, so my argument was, I mean, one of the things we can fix, it seems to me, is we can make these policies more transparent. We can do something to tell people, okay, here are the things that it takes to become a full professor. And, you know, I interviewed women who really had been horribly treated in the process of promotion who said to me, you know, just tell me what it takes. I don't care. Like, it could take 150 articles, but if you'll just, you know, if you'll just tell me what it takes, then ultimately at least I'll know, you know, if I'm there or not. I can measure myself. You know, I don't want to, you know, and the argument from administrators, or not so much administrators, but often senior faculty, was, well, we don't want to specify too clearly because we want to be able to protect people. We want to be able to protect our right to govern ourselves. But, you know, ultimately those people didn't feel particularly protected by, you know, that paternalistic, you know, we'll take care of you if you'll trust us kind of attitude. And I think paternalism works even less well the more diverse the faculty becomes, right? Because it's easy to take care of people who look just like you, right? That's Cantor's argument about homosocial reproduction, right? That's why the people always look the same. But transparency becomes more important, I think, with higher levels of diversity. Now, I think So I was making that argument, and an argument I still believe, but, I mean, what was pointed out to me, and it's true, is that that's only as good as the culture of a department that implements those policies, because you can say, you know, okay, it takes 8 papers or it takes 12 papers in good quality journals. Mm-hmm. And if somebody doesn't want to promote someone, then ultimately that becomes a conversation about, well, but this journal doesn't really count because it's not high enough quality, or this journal, you know, you weren't, I mean, and I saw cases like that, you know, a woman who had, you know, more money than anybody else in her department consistently.
In terms of grants?
Yeah. And somebody said, well, but she's not really a leader on those grants, and so therefore they don't count, right? And so, you know, policies can always be picked apart by someone with motivation. I think that's true. But I think some policies are better than no policies. Some transparency is better than no transparency. So I think culture matters, but I think, you know, policy would be a first step.
Because obviously it's a little bit difficult to define leadership in the kinds of terms that we've been using here.
Right, right.
So what do we do? I mean, where do we go from here? And what kinds of steps can we take at universities to ensure that women have equal access and opportunity to reach this rank?
Well, I think policy matters, right? So I certainly would like to see more transparency in the documents that specify, you know, what's required for promotion at various levels. Other things I have seen on campuses, for example, there was one campus I interviewed on that had a mandatory 5-year review. And post-tenure review has been a controversial topic because in a number of states, legislators who are worried that professors aren't really doing anything after they get tenure have imposed reviews from the top. But what I mean in this case is that you could request it. You could say, okay, you know, after this many years, I want to be reviewed, or that after 5 years, a committee would be convened just to tell you where you are, right? Mm-hmm. So here's where you are on the path. Because if you don't create an expectation that people are going to go up, then ultimately they don't, right? Mm-hmm. There was one campus I was on in which the dean had decided to look at some people who had been long-term associates, and he said, look, if you will put together a package of what support you think you need to reach the next level with your research, it might be a summer research assistant, it might be a teaching release, it might be for during this period, we'll see if we can get you back on track. Because often there's a trough in the middle of people's careers. So we give startup packages to people at the beginning. So we hire them and we give them all this money to set up their labs. And when people get to the end of their careers and they have some status, then they might get an endowed chair, or they might get, but in the middle, there's really nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So if you get off track in the middle and you lose your funding source, as scientists often do, right? They'll get a grant renewed 2 or 3 times and then it's not renewed again. Those people need money to sort of get back on the ramp. So I think policies matter. I think review matters. I think ways to sort of help people out of that mid-career trough matter. I think equitable distributions of service matter. And I think the service pie has to be cut in a more realistic way. So, for example, I saw this often if faculty were, you know, faculty of color or women faculty. There weren't many women faculty in a department. They're often doing a lot of service out of the department. So they would be, you know, they would mentor the Society of Women Engineers, right, which is a college-wide thing and not a department thing. Or they would work with the minority students in some area or another. But that service, the department chair in those departments did not count that as part of the pie. Right, so it didn't count as this is part of the pie of service our department does. Instead, it was just extra on top of the service they were already doing. So not only, I think, does it have to be divided equitably, but it has to be a more realistic assessment of what kind of service is being done. And I think the solution, which is the common one, of telling people to just sort of don't do it, don't say, you know, just say no, it doesn't work. I mean, somebody's got to do that service, ultimately. I think, you know, women often feel more compelled to do it, and it's certainly hard for new faculty to turn it down. And the other piece, I think, is that if you're a minority in a department, if you're a faculty of color, faculty member of color, for example, you might get some reward out of working with the Minority Student Engineering Association or whatever, and it feels alienating to be told, you know, don't do it, keep your head down, don't ever work with anybody, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't think, as it's not really one problem, it's not really one solution. But I think a variety of things could thoughtfully go into helping to solve the problem.
Well, I think you and I both realize that change is extremely slow.
Yes.
And, you know, it doesn't matter if you are in a smaller college or a very large research-based mm-hmm. institution. Mm-hmm. So for women who are currently facing this glass ceiling, mm-hmm. trying to advance themselves in faculty rankings, mm-hmm. do you have any advice for them?
well, I mean, I think... There are ways to improve your situation in terms of, you know, building relationships with mentors who can tell you what it really takes, right? So, I mean, first of all, you sort of have to think about yourself as a candidate for full professor, right? I mean, there are people who don't want to do that, and that's, you know, in the academy, no one will force you to be a full professor, right? But I think it does matter, and it matters for women, and I think it often matters in ways we don't know until we become one. It certainly, I didn't know until I became one how much difference it makes, really, to see a woman. I mean, at my previous institution, I was the only woman full professor in the department, and only the second in its history. So, and I'm in sociology, which is a female-dominated discipline at this point. So I think it matters. I mean, I think women have to think of themselves as candidates for full. They have to figure out what it takes, and if that takes a mentor or it takes a department chair. Ultimately, I think sometimes what faculty don't realize is that you're sort of in charge of your own case. You know, it's up to you to keep track. It's up to you to document, you know, here are the things I did in this project or in this. There are, you know, in terms of work-family, there are often challenges for women in terms of, you know, one of the things people want to see are linear productivity. So they want to see you did two articles this year and two the next. But if you have a small child or you're caring for a sick family member or you're, sometimes that's problematic. So dealing with all of those things early is better than dealing with them, you know, trying to account for them later on. It would depend. I think all of these, there are some patterns clearly among faculty members, but each case is going to have a different set of, you know, a different set of characteristics. But one way to do it, I mean, one way to think about it is to at least demystify the process for yourself as much as you can.
I'd like to take a moment right now just to talk about how you came about this topic.
Sure.
Now, as an author of two books and several articles on concentrating on gender, but as it's seen within the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. within the prison system, mm-hmm. how did you come about this project?
Yes. Well, you know, my specialty is in gender and work, and I took on the prison work not really because I had an intrinsic interest in prisons, but I was looking for, at that time, I was interested in sex-segregated occupations, and I was looking for a case study in which there was a female-dominated case in which men were integrating the occupation and a male-dominated case in which women were integrating the occupation, and I wanted those cases to be as parallel as I could get them, and so the prison, it's a very nice, very parallel case study. But my interest has always been in gender and work, and this project came along as part of the NSF Advance program. And so the National Science Foundation, many years ago, decided that they were interested in the participation of women in science, and they have went through iterations of at least two or three programs to try to promote that. The NSF Advance Institutional Transformation Grant, which Rutgers and many other campuses have had, are big $3.5 million or so grants that are about affecting various areas of a campus climate and campus policies and procedures in ways that make it more welcoming to women. The grant that I got was an NSF Advance paid grant, which is Partnerships for Adaptation, Implementation, and Dissemination. A paid research grant to look at this particular issue. My own experience with promotion to full had not been all that great, and I think when it came along, it was just something that interested me. The original grant was supposed to have funded, I think, 80 interviews, and by the time I was done, I had done 178.
So you are finished with it now?
I'm done with the interviewing. I'm in the process of coding the data. So I can tell you what my long-term associates felt, and so mm-hmm. those are associate professors in rank 7+, but I have not systematically analyzed the rest of the data.
Will this research be part of a bigger project that you'd like to share with us?
Well, ultimately I expect some articles and probably a book to come out of it. If I can't get a book out of 178 interviews, I probably wasn't paying attention.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sitting down with me and talking a little bit about your research.
This is fun.